On today's episode of Attention Alva, we'll be speaking with a great leader and part of U.S. military history. Stay tuned. You won't want to miss this episode. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning into Attention Alva, the podcast for the American Latino Veterans Association. We're super excited to have you join us today. I'm your host, Danny Vargas, Chairman and CEO of Alva. In addition to these podcasts where you get to hear from inspiring guests, we also have a series of webinars where we'll get to learn really important information on significant topics. And keep an eye out for our future events by visiting our website, alvavets.org, and follow us on social media on @alvavets. We really want to thank our sponsors for these podcasts and webinars, JPMorgan Chase, PMI, Wells Fargo, AT&T, and T-Mobile. The one thing I ask is please like, share, comment, and subscribe. It really helps with the algorithm. So if you can hit that subscribe button, we really would appreciate it. Now it's my pleasure to introduce our special guest for today, Olga Custodio. Olga, welcome.
Thank you for having me. Good to see you.
My pleasure. I'm going to read your bio real quick so people know who it is that we're speaking with. Olga Custodio is a Latina military and commercial airline aviation pioneer with over 40 years in aviation. As the first Latina to complete U.S. Air Force undergraduate pilot training, she served for 24 years and retired as a lieutenant colonel. Olga was also the first American Airlines Latina commercial airline pilot and retired as a captain with a 20-year career. Now a STEM advocate, speaker, author, and community leader, she advocates for inspiring and empowering students, especially underserved communities, to pursue STEM careers in aviation and aerospace. Olga continues to fly in general aviation. She lives in San Antonio, Texas, military city, with her husband, Edwin, 51 years, and has two adult children, Marcia and Edwin, and one grandson, Jedi. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
I would also add that Olga is a founding member of the ALVA Advisory Council. Thank you, Olga, for serving.
Absolutely. My honor.
Appreciate it. And thank you for joining us today. There is one other thing that we'll get into later, but she's also a published author that has a book coming out soon. So when it comes to that time, I would love to hear more about the book and the experience and where people can get it. But why don't we start, Olga, by taking a step back in time. And by the way, I can't believe the numbers that I just read. Because you look so young, my God.
Well, thank you. What's
your secret?
It's DNA.
You have great genes. Yes, your dad is 99. Is that right?
99, and Borincaneer still around with us.
Phenomenal. I'll get into that later about Borincaneers. But I did want to start by talking about your personal journey. You know, growing up in Puerto Rico. Before you joined the military and your school and all that stuff. So let's take a trip back in time and get to learn more about your upbringing.
Right. No, absolutely. Absolutely. So I'll just get right to it, I guess.
Please, yeah.
So I was born in Puerto Rico. My mom and dad, they're both from a small town up in the hills called Corozal. And that's where they met. And so my dad went off. He was in the latter part of World War II and in the Korean War. Got married, mom and dad, and then had me. I was born on the island. And about 3 months after I left, and mom and I followed dad, and we were with him the whole time until my brother was born. He was the addition to the family. But I wish I could have grown up in Puerto Rico, but I did not. Being an Army brat, I grew up everywhere in the U.S. As a small child. And around, I guess, 4 or 5 years old, we moved to Taiwan. From Taiwan, came back to the States for a year or so, and then went to Iran, and then we went to Paraguay. So I consider myself a world citizen, if you will, because I was able to experience all those different countries and the cultures and the people. It was very hard, just being an army a brat, if you will. But looking back, it was an experience that kind of made me who I am today, and my views and my perspectives of so many things and you know, and the world itself. So yeah, I think that was very influential for me. And I'm grateful, even though at the time it was, like I said, it was very hard, you know, being an Army child and moving, and but that taught me a lot of stuff, you know, on how to adapt, how to make the best of the situation at the moment, and seeing different cultures and people and understanding what humanity is all about, I guess.
Well, of those countries, what was your favorite country?
I think Paraguay, only because I was older. There, you know, Spanish was my first language, and we spoke it at home all the time. But I think the fact that in Paraguay, I was able to learn how to read and write it, which was great, because when Dad retired and we moved back to Puerto Rico right after Paraguay, I went to school, you know, and then I had never, you know, experienced a different language school. Everything was Department of Defense schools in English, which were fantastic. I have to say that having the textbooks in English in Puerto Rico, but having the class taught in Spanish really developed that double sense of being able to learn how to think in Spanish and speak it, and how to think in English and speak it at the same time. So I wasn't, at first I was translating, you know how that goes. You're translating, okay, how's this word and that word? So, but I think Paraguay was great because it was South America, Hispanic culture, and kind of similar to who we are and were at the time.
And amazing steaks.
Oh yeah, no, the food was great. You know, I mean, we were so used to, this is a side note, to having, you know, these awesome cuts of meat, carnivorous person as myself, and potatoes and fresh vegetables and all. We get to Puerto Rico and there's a lot of rice and beans and a little bit of chuleta.
That's you know? Right.
And I'm like, where's the meat? So it was a change, but it was fine. And I was happy to go to Puerto Rico and learn about my culture. So that was a great opportunity for me.
So where'd you end up going to school?
In Puerto Rico.
So university. Yeah.
Oh, I went to the University of Puerto Rico. So I went, when we got there, I had one more year of high school. And I graduated high school at 16 because of the Department of Defense schools. I was able to have all my credits that I needed to graduate. And so I went ahead and went to college at that young age. So, yeah, it was interesting. And I still remember that the college credit was $5.
Wow. Not that nowadays.
No. Then that was just a minute ago, right? You know, so a long time ago.
So then after college came the Air Force?
So no. So when I went to college, I had a plan, you know. I always tell my kids when they would come up to me and say, hey, I want to do this. I said, so tell me your plan. What's your plan? How are you going to execute this, right? And so I had a plan. I was going to get a degree in math. And then I was going to go to the ROTC, join the Air Force ROTC, and get my commission, and then serve my country in the Air Force. That was the big thing for me. But unbeknownst to me, I was rejected because, and the commander never told me this, women weren't allowed in the program. So that was my first denial, rejection, and I say that I experienced discrimination without even knowing it. You know, It was like, well, he's an authority figure, right? The ROTC commander said, "I'm sorry, but you don't qualify," and you press on. So Plan A becomes Plan B. And I had to kind of look for what I was going to do. So I went to the, got into business, but I still did a minor in math And then from there, I started working with, in my last year of college, working with the Puerto Rico International Airlines. That was the largest commuter airline in Puerto Rico and in the world at that moment. And I was in the accounting office. I worked for the controller there. And that's where I met my husband.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So, nice guy, by the way. I've met him. He's a great guy.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I like him too.
You're like, I think I'll keep him.
Yeah, he's a keeper. He's a keeper. So, but the interesting part and is that I was in my fifth year of university because they had to close the college down because of students just had marches and all kinds of things that were going on, and they had to close the university down for a semester. So it just pushed me back. And I took my last night classes at night, and I was able to work full time. So, but fast forward, met my husband. 3 months later, we're married, right? And I'm sure everybody on the side was taking bets. Let's see how long this lasts.
Yeah.
But anyway, about 2 years in, we sat down, decided, hey, let's consider joining the military. My husband had 3 years of college, and he was thinking maybe that could help him finish school, maybe a GI Bill and that sort of thing. Sure enough. So we went to a recruiter, and I asked about both of us joining. Oh, they said, absolutely. We took the AFOQT, got the highest scores, and I knew that I was going to be able to apply for an officer training position because of my degree and the scores, but the recruiter said no. My second denial. So I said, fine. And he offered me to enlist, but that's not what the plan was or my goal. I go, no, I know I'm qualified for something more. I'm not going to accept something less. And then my father, while in the service, he tried as well to become a warrant officer. And he had shared a story with me that it was very hard once you're in, you know, to kind of break rank and step up. So I remember that. And I said, no, once I'm in, that this officer training school is never going to happen. So I said no. But my husband joined, and I figured I'd be just like my mom, you know, a military spouse serving as well and supporting him. And then off we went. So he joined the Air Force first.
Can I ask, going back, for why the Air Force? Your father was Army.
Right. Well, when we went on the assignments, and he was able to take us at every assignment that he had, I saw the difference. It, unbeknownst to me, but I realized Army versus Air Force versus Marine, Navy, I could see the difference of service and people and what they did and what the mission was. And I figured that the Air Force would be a good fit for me.
As an Air Force veteran, I can tell you, it's true, and my Army, Navy, Marine Corps friends are just jealous.
Yeah. So, yeah, they would joke around like we would get everything, and then it would trickle down to the Army, and then it would trickle down to the Navy, and then the Marines would get the less. And we're like, okay. So.
Mm-hmm. So I do want to get into your Air Force career, but I promised we'd go talk about the Borinqueneers, and your father was a Borinqueneer. Right. I'll share with you, and I think I may have mentioned this to you. We did an awards event in New York City in December of 2024 in Central Park. Fantastic event. But one of the most moving moments was we had a 94-year-old Bronze Star recipient, Korean War veteran Borinqueneer, who we gave an award to at the event. And he had been prepared to say a few words on receiving the award. But when I read his bio and his award nomination, he got so emotional that he couldn't speak. Oh. So he started tearing up. I had to take him in my arms, and it just led me to think that there are so many of these folks that didn't get the recognition that they deserved for the service and sacrifice that they made. And so many of them are passing away, you know, over time. Mm-hmm. So the least we can do is to honor and recognize their service, and make sure that everyone understands that that was a period of time where that segregated unit was discriminated against both in the military and in broader society. So thank you to you and your dad and your family service, because, you know, a sacrifice like that is not just an individual sacrifice, it's a family sacrifice.
Yes, yes. And I think everything they did, and I was able to see the documentary, which is, oh my God, you know, it just overwhelms you sometimes to find out everything that they went through. But I had the honor to go with my dad to DC when they actually gave out the Congressional Gold Medal of Honor. And to me, that was the best experience, to experience it with my mom, my dad, and my husband went as well as a family, because he, you know, having my husband served as well. So we were all very proud of that moment, proud of the 65th. And everyone that was able to go, and the families that were there to support those veterans. But yes, you know, and dad had the opportunity to travel to Korea, where they really appreciated, you know, everything that they did for that country. And it brought my dad full circle. He kept saying, when I was there, everything was just dirt. And when he went and he saw the metropolis that is there, and it made him feel that everything he did was not in vain, you know. Mm-hmm. That they
did. Valió la pena.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So let's get back to you. Let's talk about your service in the Air Force, which is such an exemplary record, and everything that you did as the first Latina. Let's talk about how you accomplished that. How did you cut through the barriers and the obstacles to make that happen?
Well, I was in Panama on the Canal Zone with my husband. He had got an assignment there, and it was just at that time. I worked for the Canal Zone. Government and the Panama Canal Company, and in their equal opportunity office of all offices to talk about, right? And so I learned a whole bunch there, and I started to figure out, you know, what I was going to do as a career, because I always knew I would work outside the home. That was not an option for me. I was a mom at the time. We had a 2-year-old when we moved to Panama. So I was working outside the home, and I wanted to see if I followed Edwin where we would go. I would still have some type of continuity for career progression. And so I applied for the Department of Defense and got a civil service job. And I figured that would be the best way for me, you know, to serve and to have a career, so I could transfer to any other position wherever they assigned him. So one summer, about a year or so later, they had an open house, and here is a booth, a guy in a flight suit standing behind, had pamphlets and everything, and I'm trying to inquire what he was trying to sell, right? And sure enough, the Air Force was looking for female pilot candidates. Right time, right place. You know, me, I was like, that's it. That is what I'm going for. And so the best thing is I had already gotten a Department of Defense job, and I had access to all the regulations. And that is something I think that made a huge difference for me. Because now I wanted to make sure that I had all the information straight from the regulations, black and white, that nobody was going to tell me otherwise, that I couldn't, I didn't qualify, and what have you. So I went ahead and researched all that, found a staff sergeant whose additional duty was to recruit high school students. He had never recruited anyone for an officer slot. Mm-hmm. And so I told him, no worries, let me help you help me, and we're going to do this together. And that's exactly what happened. He ordered all the tests, everything I needed. I knew my minimum scores, what kind of medical exams I needed, and ratings as far as, you know, physical that would qualify me to apply for a pilot position. And by that time, I was just determined, you know, if I'm going to serve, that's what I want to be. I want to be a pilot. You know, we had friends that were pilots, navigators. Edwin worked at base operations, airfield management. So we were around them all the time. And I had a good sense of what that was about. Plus, my supervisor, where I worked for the Department of Defense, it was at the Howard Air Force Base, which is no longer, right?
That's where I was stationed.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so I was there for almost 5 years in the 80s. Oh, wow.
In the 80s.
Yep.
Right. Well, see, we were there right before, like 78, 79. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, the best food ever.
Yes, for but, sure.
Fresh seafood, all of that. But anyway, I made sure that all the exams and tests that I took, I was able to get, you know, with the staff sergeant, everything together, build a good package to send up to headquarters personnel so it could meet the board. And having, you know, working at the air terminal, the DO was able to write a letter and get a general endorsement for me. And so it worked out. Little hiccup, we got word that my package somehow had gotten ruined, torn up. And so a call to the staff sergeant, he calls me and says, hey, your package isn't going to meet the board. I don't know what happened to it. We didn't ask questions. What do we need to do to make sure? So we had to redo a bunch of paperwork, and it had to be there like within 4 or 5 days.
Wow.
And from Panama. So luckily, my husband working at base operations, he had connections with the air crews that came in and out. And he goes, hey, I need a favor. My wife's package is supposed to meet the board. Anyway, we can get this up there. And so one of the guys that he would help out all the time, aircraft commander, said, sure, what do you need? So they called somebody at headquarters personnel, said, you meet this aircraft at Kelly Air Force Base. They're going to hand you a package and you're going to take it up, and it's got to meet the board. And so, you know, stars aligned, everything. I met the board, and that December I got the letter that I was accepted as a pilot candidate for the Air Force.
Wow, that is huge. What an incredible story. So is the moral of the story, you know, luck is one thing, but preparation is at least as important as luck?
How would I say? You always have to be prepared. Always. No matter what. And you just wait for that. How would I say? Look for the possibilities and you'll find your opportunity.
That's right. That's what I say. There you go. Yep. So that meant then OTS?
OTS. So actually, first I went to the flight screening program. It's a program that you have to fly for about 20, you get 20 hours, and it's a two-way interview. The candidates get to see what the Air Force is all about, and the Air Force get to see what the candidates' potential is to go through flight training. And it's a really fast-paced program, so if you can't keep up, you know, a lot of people don't make it, or if they don't like what they see, or the training and how pilot training could be like. So they say no. They say that this is not for me, and the candidate has the option to just say goodbye. I'm out of here. I'm not going to do this. So.
So you did that.
Right.
And then OTS?
And then officer training school. Correct. Mm-hmm. So being one of the only females at officer training school who was a pilot candidate, during the flight screening, we got to wear flight suits, right? So everybody kind of looked down on us, like, who are these people, right? And so that was unique. And then at officer training school, we got to wear these little wings that identified us as pilot candidates. So it was good, but I was able to, you know, find leadership positions within the cadet program. And so the best thing was, once you became a cadet leader, you left the normal dorm and you were able to go and hang out with all the cadet officers, you know, commanders. We had a special dorm. So we kind of helped each other and hung out like that. So, but it was a great experience. I got my commission. And from there, I went to Laughlin Air Force Base to start undergraduate pilot training. My husband stayed behind. Mm-hmm. And luckily, he was able to get a joint assignment with me at Laughlin Air Force Base, him being in airfield management. So that kind of worked out for that.
That's perfect. So tell me about that experience, the flight training.
Well, the flight training for me, you start, this was a year-long program. Right. You know, now pilot training has definitely changed. They're trying to shrink it down to 6 months and wow. even further. But I think they're realizing that some shortcuts aren't the best, you know. With the new technology and everything. But for me, it was a year-long program. By then, our daughter was, when I started, was 4 years old. And so we had that. And, you know, him full-time Air Force, me full-time pilot training student. My hours were pretty much 12-hour days. So it sometimes was hard to balance all of that, but we made it work and we found our village. But the first couple of weeks, physiological training, they taught us how to do parachute landing falls. They put us in a hyperbaric chamber just to make sure that, you know, we could withstand, know what our symptoms are if we lost oxygen and that sort of thing. And then we started right into the T-37, which was a twin engine jet equivalent to the A-37 at the time, is what they use as a fighter. And then from there, that first phase, we went to our second phase, and they used T-38s, which was an equivalent to an F-5 fighter for us to fly as well. That was my favorite airplane, still is and always will be. The T-38, supersonic, you know, you have a G suit, you got your helmet, your parachute, all of that. And I have to say that parachute weighs a ton.
I know.
But flying that airplane was amazing. And they still use it. They keep saying, we're going to retire the airplane, but it's still there.
I was airborne reconnaissance, right? I was a Spanish linguist. I spent most of my life on a C-130.
Oh, yeah.
But almost 3,000 hours on a C-130, but it's still one of the most capable, durable airframes that we have.
It is. And we have our best friend at that time when I was applying. He flew C-130s, and that's where Edwin was stationed before we went to Panama. It was Little Rock Air Force Base, and that's where they have the C-130s training. And I always loved that airplane. You know, those assault landings and takeoffs were amazing. So And the flight deck alone, you know, all those windows that you have from up here all the way down to your feet, just, I really enjoyed it. But of course, when I graduated, women weren't allowed to be in combat. So we had that combat exclusion. And the only aircraft that I could have flown was a 141, a 135, and, you know, I guess a small Learjet that flew generals around. But I loved my T-38, and I did so well in pilot training. I top 5%. I say 5%. I was like a top third in my class, and I got my fighter reconnaissance rating in order to fly the T-38, which is an equivalent of having a fighter rating to go on and get a fighter aircraft. But women weren't allowed at the time, so I got the fastest aircraft that a female could fly at the time.
So how many women were with you in that class?
So in that class, there was one other female that was in the class, but on the second week, she washed out. So she didn't make it through the program. And I always say, you know, because when I graduated, I got my rating. I became a T-38 instructor pilot. And I always looked at students. So I said, look, you have to have at least 15 to 20% of skills and ability to fly an airplane. But the other 80% is all motivation. If you're not motivated enough, you're not going to make it through the program. And that's right. what it was. So she wasn't motivated. She was like, oh, I just got this and this is fun. And I'm like, okay.
So not only were you the first Latino, you were probably among the first females.
Yes, absolutely. There weren't that many of us. In fact, I was the first T-38 instructor pilot female to go to Laughlin and teach at Laughlin. And at that moment, when I came back, they had just assigned a T-37 female instructor to the other squadron. So there were two of us in the whole base.
That's incredible. Mm-hmm. And being Latina, how did that sort of aspect of your background and so forth impact sort of the situation and the environment around you?
Well, I think it's West Texas, you know, so very Hispanic. So to me, it was no big deal. And I guess to most people, mm-hmm. or it was probably the way I presented and projected myself. You know, I mean, I knew I was different because I was a female, just because I was Latina, you know, it was not something that I would say, oh my gosh, look at me, I'm Latina. But I was very proud of the fact, and everybody knew I was, and they knew I was from Puerto Rico and all of that. And so West Texas, in Del Rio, Texas, there were a lot of Hispanics around. So it felt very comfortable to me. And I just considered myself one of, you know, of my peers, the same, obviously, a female versus a male. That would, to me, was the only difference. Because, you know, I mean, the way I saw culture and heritage was growing up in that. It's like, okay, you're Irish or you're whatever, you know, you're different. Your culture's different, but we're all here for the same purpose. So
absolutely,
we're all together. So that's how it was for me. And anybody who tried, and there were instructors that tried to make it very hard for me in training. Even at the flight screening program, there was an instructor who did not give me all the tools that I needed to do a certain flight, and he failed me. But I was much older then, you know, I was already 26 years old. So I was very, if you will, wise, you know, and I knew how to advocate for myself and stand up for myself. So I went up the chain of command and said, hey, this is what happened. and made sure that I went through the cadet chain of command and then the active duty chain of command. And anyway, so they sat the instructor down with the contractor supervisor and everybody. And they asked him, did this really happen? He goes, yes. And he got fired. But
oh, wow.
I stood up for myself.
There you go. Know,
because you just can't keep quiet. You can't have people, you know, make you feel like you're wrong, because I already knew what I had to do. So, and then in pilot training, there was an instructor. I always remember this. He looked at me very early on. He says, you're not going to make it through this program. And I guess he helped light a fire under me. I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm going to prove you wrong. So he thought he was trying to get me to quit, but it was a totally opposite effect. You know, it was like, oh, yeah, watch this. I'm going to make it.
And I hold my beer.
Love that. Yeah. Hold my beer. I'll be back in a second.
So that's awesome.
Yeah.
So that was 24 years in the Air Force?
Almost. Yeah. Almost.
So what were the highlights or lowlights?
So I stayed there at Laughlin as an instructor pilot, because I think because of my maturity and being a female, I was able to work with the students who weren't doing very well, the weaker students, and my supervisors saw that. I was, had different techniques on how to get the students back up to standards for the syllabus. And they noticed that, so they recommended me to go to Randolph Air Force Base to become an instructor pilot at pilot instructor training. So I was teaching pilots to become instructors in a T-38. And so I was recommended, applied, and got assigned there, being the first female in that squadron as well.
Wow.
So... yeah. And I really enjoyed that because, you know, here, at least the pilots aren't trying to kill you.
That's right.
As the students. And they knew how to fly, you know. So I just needed to teach them how to talk and fly at the same time to be able to teach students. So I really enjoyed that. And then from there, I went back my last year and a half to the flight screening program. And became an operations officer there, overseeing the program because it was a contract, and it was in Hondo, Texas. And we would supervise the contract, do check rides, check out their instructors, and check out some of the students there. And I had an opportunity to stand up an operation at Emory-Riddle in Daytona Beach, Florida. For a summer. And so they selected five of us, not from Randolph, but from different training bases, to make up this group to go out, check out the Emory-Riddle instructor pilots that they had there on staff, so they could teach our syllabus and fly the ROTC students during the summer. So we'd get ROTC students coming in, we'd do flight training with them, and then I think we had three classes. So I went TDY from May to August to Daytona Beach.
Rough assignment.
Rough, right? So I rented an apartment and got my parents to bring the kids to spend the summer with me there. My husband came to visit once or twice. Because he was still working, so had gotten out by that time. He had gotten out of active duty and worked civil service, so he was doing that.
So in that trajectory of time, I assume you were able to see more and more women getting into flight training.
Right, but there still weren't enough.
Many,
of us.
Yeah. even though aviation for women and Latinas is such a wonderful option for many of them that are interested in doing it. And I know you continue to advocate for that. So after 24 years in the Air Force, you made a change.
Well, actually, after 8 years in the Air Force, active duty, I made a change. So I transitioned from active duty to the reserves.
Right.
I went to officer training school for a bit, a year in the reserves, and then I transitioned to headquarters personnel. So I worked at headquarters personnel for the remainder of the time, 16 years. I worked at the Accountability and Readiness Directorate there, which was incredible. I had to stand up alongside the Red Cross when 9/11 hit.
Oh boy.
And that was something else, but we can talk about that later. But I was working for American Airlines. So I went and I applied to fly for American Airlines. Well, several airlines, but I settled for American Airlines because, you know, right place, right time, felt right, good fit, and it worked out. And I had a 20-year career with them. But I stayed in the reserves because my commitment was always to serve, and I wanted to finish what I started, and I did. So I was able to do that, and anytime I had reserve duty, I would get time off from work and be able to come back home and do my duty time.
And your airline career, 20 years is such an impressive time to be a pilot. My niece's husband is a pilot as well for JetBlue after he got out of the Marine Corps.
Oh, nice.
It's a big transition, but it's still similar skills.
Right.
And it's just it's a different payload.
Yes, it is. I mean, you, how would I say, anybody on board an aircraft is, and you know this, you know, safety paramount, number one. The mission, of course, you know, Air Force versus commercial is you get your passengers to their destination on time, right? depending on weather and any situation that might arise. So I really enjoyed seeing the people, taking them on vacation or wherever their destination was. I know when I upgraded to captain, and when we still had time, because now the flight schedules are really crazy. You know, you jump into the flight deck, you get the airplane ready, everybody's boarding, you're doing your checklist, shut the door and off we go, and you land. And sometimes you never see the pilot because they're picking up or doing whatever, getting ready for their next flight. So they don't right. say hello, they don't say goodbye. But luckily when I upgraded, we still had a little time to get passengers on board. So there was one story where a lady was boarding my aircraft. I was a captain at the time. And she looked very confused. And I approached her and, you know, tried to welcome her aboard. And I saw she was concerned. And I asked her if anything was wrong. And she looked at me and said, "Oh, you're the captain." And I confirmed that for her. "Yes, ma'am, I'm the captain. Welcome aboard." And I saw her concern. And I said, "Look, if you don't feel comfortable getting on this aircraft, you're more than welcome to go back up the jet bridge and talk to the agent and see if they can rebook you on the next available flight, which will be in an hour or so to the same destination." But she just kind of lowered her eyes and walked down the aisle and went to sit down. But anyway, it was.
I'm sure on the inside you were thinking something else.
No, I was like, wow, you know, I never expected that. And from a female, you know, I could see that coming, you know, getting a man on board and going, "Hey, you're the captain." Yeah. But it was like, come on, you know, be proud, you know, yeah, cheer us on. But I have to say that the flight attendants who I flew with, anytime they look in the flight deck and they would see me, boy, they defended me all the time. They said,
"That's awesome.
She has qualified to be there. She's worked hard, and we only hire great pilots. So don't worry, like, move along. But I would get these stories when we, you know, land final flight of the day, and we'd be going to our hotel layover, and they would share those stories with me. So great flight attendants. And I have to say, male and female, they were all very supportive. When I first got there, obviously the captains that they had, I called them crusty old captains. They really didn't want us there. They didn't know why that the airline was hiring females, pilots. And it was a different culture.
Mm-hmm.
It took a couple of years for the culture to change, but you know, I wasn't going anywhere. And I would look at those captains. I said, "You're retiring soon, so please get out of my seat because I'm moving up."
Get out of my chair.
Yes. Absolutely.
There you go. I got to love that. Yeah. So incredibly fulfilling career. You did so much in your career, both in the Air Force and in the airlines. But I think there's also a lot to be said for what you've done in the community. So you've done a lot of things in the community to help a lot of people, and many people just may not know that about you. So why don't you share a little bit about your community type activities?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I want to say that even while I was still flying, I made sure I was involved, you know, with my kids. My daughter was in Girl Scouts. I would do that, especially for the Girl Scouts, so they could see what that was like. This is kind of interesting. So my daughter's in middle school. I'm still active duty pilot. One of her teachers finds out that I am a pilot and makes a huge deal about it. Oh my God, your mother. So for my daughter, that was normal. Like, yeah, every other mom is a pilot, right? But it wasn't. And she didn't realize that until her teacher said, oh no, she needs to come in and talk to the class. And so that's kind of where my daughter realized, wow, what mom does, you know, she knew it was different, but she didn't know it was that different and unique. And so I went and started talking to the class, and I got involved, like I said, with the Girl Scout troop. And that just really showed me the need to have female, strong female leaders and professionals in schools and in groups to make sure that they could see us and have that little seed planted. So after I retired, well, throughout, you know, I would go and speak to troops, schools, community groups, and I really enjoyed being able to show what the possibilities were for females. And after I retired, I said, you know what, I've got a blessed career, blessed life. I mean, it wasn't easy, you know, you give and take that personal and work balance, very important. And I wanted to make sure that the underserved community, especially people and kids who are not around, especially aviation and aerospace, have that opportunity. I want to share that with them, open their eyes, and let them know that that's always a possibility. And I think the important part is that they are smart enough and have the capability of achieving this. And if it's not this, anything else. That's so awesome. I push aviation and aerospace, I push STEM, but whatever they want to achieve, you know, I let them know that it's doable, but they have to hang in there and believe themselves. And I think that's the first step of knowing that, you know, we're all capable of that given the right environment. And I talk about who they hang out with as well. So it's not only, you know, study, study. Yeah, studies education, you know, education, and I always say this, education and information helps you make better decisions. But it's the people who you hang out with that are going to make that difference. So make sure that whoever's around you supports what you're trying to achieve.
If you can dream it, you can do it if you work hard enough and persevere.
Exactly. And then I said, just put it out in the universe. So tell everybody and anybody what you want to do, because you never know who's going to help you. So I continue to do that. And right now I sit on several nonprofit boards who advocate for aviation and aerospace, military, civilian. We're doing the best we can in this community. And now I'm a speaker, a motivational and professional speaker. I speak around the country with different colleges, universities, and I have a couple of agencies that help me get those contracts so I can share the story and try and inspire others.
And you have an event coming up that you're going to.
Yes. So next week, I'm going to attend the Women in Aviation Conference. It's going to be in Denver this year. We gather, and it's international. I mean, there's groups that come from Africa, from Australia, Europe, from all over, and we gather there, and they're in all kinds of professions. So just because it's aviation doesn't mean that everybody's a pilot. So it's right. In operations, it's in maintenance, just so many different professions that you can be. And that's what I tell kids. I said, you don't have to be a pilot to be in aviation. If you love what it is in aerospace, you can be an engineer, you can be a lawyer, you can be a medical person and still be involved in aviation. So it doesn't matter what your career path takes you. If you love aviation, you can still be a part of it.
Absolutely. You know, a couple of years ago in 2023, we had the pleasure of giving an award to Graciela Tiscareño Soto. So, and I know she's a big advocate for that as well.
She is. She's an amazing lady. To me, she's the ever ready, but the bunny, is that right?
Yeah, the Energizer Bunny.
Energizer Bunny, that's it. And that lady is nonstop. You know, I see her and I'm like, okay, slow down, Graciela. You know, take it easy, take a beat, because she's go, go, go. And she's got three kids and, you know, I mean, amazing, amazing lady. And an author. And I said, well, one day I'll write my book. She goes, just write, just sit down and start writing. And I said, okay. So I'd write little stories here and there and put it all on paper. But I just never got the moment or found the right time or right person to help me do that. And luckily, if everything goes well, I will be launching my book next week at the Women in Aviation Conference in Denver.
That is fantastic. Congratulations, an author. Let's hear about Flight Path of Fortitude.
Yes. So I think the best thing that describes this is just different parts of my story put into different chapters. I think this is kind of a memoir for me. You know, I mean, at some point I'm going to, and like I said to people, as long as I have the energy and I really can get involved and people still want to hear what I have to say, I'm going to be involved with the community. But I think it's time this book comes out. So people know the real me, my whole story, and can understand why I have the perspectives and the insights that I do and that I share with others, where that came from. And it gives me that fortitude. And that's the word I'm key on, you know. Obviously, flight path, because we're in aviation, right? But fortitude is a huge word, and I think it, when I saw it and I talked to the editor, we're trying to decide what title are we going to give this book. And that just stuck with me. And I think it just encompasses perseverance, resilience, just everything. And I have a motto, and hopefully I'm going to put it as an epigraph in my book. And it's querer es poder. And I translate that to where there's a will, there's power. Mm-hmm. And I think that says it all.
I love that. That's fantastic. Is the book available for purchase yet?
Not yet. We're still tweaking it. You know, we're down to the wire, and I just want to make sure that everything gets done right. So fingers crossed, we'll launch it next week, if not in 2 weeks. But I will send out as soon as I know, you know, where we're going to post it for purchase. We'll get the word out. But just be on the lookout for it.
And we will amplify it for you. But in the meantime, folks, be on the lookout. Flight Path of Fortitude by Olga Custodio, wonderful author. Olga, just to wrap things up, I can't tell you how grateful we are for your time, for your journey, for your service, for your leadership, for who you are as a person, for serving on the advisory council for ALVA and the support that you've provided. With all that said, I know our listening audience and viewing audience would love to see if there's any pearls of wisdom that you'd like to be able to share with them in closing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It doesn't matter where you are, who you are, or what you're doing. Always ask questions and keep learning.
I love that. Always keep learning. Yes. I appreciate your time, Olga. Thank you again for joining us today. And on behalf of the American Latino Veterans Association, thanks to all of you for joining us today. We really hope you enjoy the content today. Please join us for future webinars and podcasts. And please keep an eye out for information on upcoming events by visiting our website, alvavets.org, and following us on social media at alvavets. Thank you again, Olga, for being our guest today.
Thank you.
And thanks again to our sponsors for these podcasts and webinars, JP Morgan Chase, PMI, Wells Fargo, AT&T, and T-Mobile. Thank you again for joining us. And as always, be safe, aim high, and thrive. See you next time. Thanks again.